Explaining Postmodernism, Skepticism and Socialism from Rousseau to Foucault, by Stephen Hicks, read by the author. First edition of Explaining Postmodernism was published in 2004 by Schology Publishing. The expanded edition was published in 2011 by Occam's Razor Publishing. Explaining Postmodernism, Chapter 1, What Postmodernism Is. By most accounts, we have entered a new intellectual age. We are postmodern now. Leading intellectuals tell us that modernism has died and that a revolutionary era is upon us, an era liberated from the oppressive strictures of the past, but at the same time disquieted by its expectations for the future. Even postmodernism's opponents, surveying the intellectual scene and not liking what they see, acknowledge a new cutting edge. In the intellectual world, there has been a changing of the guard. The names of the postmodern vanguard are now familiar: Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, Jean-François Lyotard, and Richard Rorty. They are its leading strategists. They set the direction of the movement and provide it with its most potent tools. The vanguard is aided by other familiar and often infamous names: Stanley Fish and Frank Lentricchia in literary and legal criticism, Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin in feminist legal criticism, Jacques Lacan in psychology, Robert Venturi and Andreas Heussen in architectural criticism, and Luce Irigaray in the criticism of science. Members of this elite group set the direction and tone for the postmodern intellectual world. Michel Foucault has identified the major targets. Quote, "All my analyses are against the idea of universal necessities in human existence." Unquote. Such necessities must be swept aside as baggage from the past. Quote, "It is meaningless to speak in the name of or against reason, truth, or knowledge." Unquote. Richard Rorty has elaborated on that theme, explaining that that is not to say that postmodernism is true or that it offers knowledge. Such assertions would be self-contradictory. So postmodernists must use language ironically. Quote, "The difficulty faced by a philosopher who, like myself, is sympathetic to this suggestion, for example, Foucault's, one who thinks of himself as auxiliary to the poet rather than to the physicist, is to avoid hinting that this suggestion gets something right, that my sort of philosophy corresponds to the way things really are. For this talk of correspondence brings back just the idea that my sort of philosopher wants to get rid of, the idea that the world or the self has an intrinsic nature." Unquote. If there is no world or self to understand and get right on their own terms, then what is the purpose of thought or action? Having deconstructed reason, truth, and the idea of the correspondence of thought to reality, and then set them aside, quote, "Reason," writes Foucault, "is the ultimate language of madness." Unquote. There is nothing to guide or constrain our thoughts and feelings, so we can do or say whatever we feel like. Deconstruction, Stanley Fish confesses happily, quote, "relieves me of the obligation to be right and demands only that I be interesting." Unquote. Many postmodernists, though, are less often in the mood for aesthetic play than for political activism. Many deconstruct reason, truth, and reality because they believe that in the name of reason, truth, and reality, Western civilization has wrought dominance, oppression, and destruction. Quote, "Reason and power are one and the same," Jean-François Lyotard states. "Both lead to and are synonymous with prisons, prohibitions, selection process, the public good." Unquote. Postmodernism then becomes an activist strategy against the coalition of reason and power. Postmodernism, Frank Lentricchia explains, quote, "seeks not to find the foundation and the conditions of truth, but to exercise power for the purpose of social change." Unquote. The task of postmodern professors is to help students, quote, "spot, confront, and work against the political horrors of one's time." Unquote. Those horrors, according to postmodernism, are most prominent in the West, Western civilization being where reason and power have been the most developed. But the pain of those horrors is neither inflicted nor suffered equally. Males, whites, and the rich have their hands on the whip of power, and they use it cruelly at the expense of women, racial minorities, and the poor. The conflict between men and women is brutal. Quote, "The normal fuck," writes Andrea Dworkin, "by a normal man is taken to be an act of invasion and ownership undertaken in a mode of predation," unquote. This special insight into the sexual psychology of males is matched and confirmed by the sexual experience of women. Quote, "Women have been chattels to men as wives, as prostitutes, as sexual and reproductive servants. Being owned and being fucked are or have been virtually synonymous experiences in the lives of women. He owns you. He fucks you. The fucking conveys the quality of ownership. He owns you inside out," unquote. Dworkin and her colleague, Catherine MacKinnon, then call for the censorship of pornography on postmodern grounds. Our social reality is constructed by the language we use, and pornography is a form of language, one that constructs a violent and domineering reality for women to submit to. Pornography, therefore, is not free speech, but political oppression. The violence is also experienced by the poor at the hands of the rich, and by the struggling nations at the hands of the capitalist nations. For a striking example, Lyotard asks us to consider the American attack on Iraq in the 1990s. Despite American propaganda, Lyotard writes, "The fact is that Saddam Hussein is a victim and a spokesman for victims of American imperialism the world over." Quote, "Saddam Hussein is a product of Western departments of state and big companies, just as Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco were born of the peace imposed on their countries by the victors of the Great War. Saddam is such a product in even more flagrant and cynical a way. But the Iraqi dictatorship proceeds, as do the others, from the transfer of aporias, that is, insoluble problems, in the capitalist system to vanquished, less developed, or simply less resistant countries," unquote. Yet the oppressed status of women, the poor, racial minorities, and others is almost always veiled in the capitalist nations. Rhetoric about trying to put the sins of the past behind us, about progress and democracy, about freedom and equality before the law, all such self-serving rhetoric serves only to mask the brutality of capitalist civilization. Rarely do we catch an honest glimpse of its underlying essence. For that glimpse, Foucault tells us, we should look to prison. Quote, "Prison is the only place where power is manifested in its naked state, in its most excessive form, and where it is justified as moral force. What is fascinating about prisons is that, for once, power doesn't hide or mask itself. It reveals itself as tyranny pursued into the tiniest details. It is cynical and at the same time pure and entirely, quote, justified," unquote, because its practice can be totally formulated within the framework of morality. Its brutal tyranny consequently appears as the serene domination of good over evil, of order over disorder, unquote. Finally, for the inspirational and philosophical source of postmodernism, for that which connects abstract and technical issues in linguistics and epistemology to political activism, Jacques Derrida identifies the philosophy of Marxism. Quote, "Deconstruction never had meaning or interest, at least in my eyes, than as a radicalization, that is to say, also within the tradition of a certain Marxism, in a certain spirit of Marxism," unquote. Modern and postmodern. Any intellectual movement is defined by its fundamental philosophical premises. Those premises state what it takes to be real, what it is to be human, what is valuable, and how knowledge is to be acquired. That is, any intellectual movement has a metaphysics, a conception of human nature and values, and an epistemology. Postmodernism often bills itself as anti-philosophical, by which it means that it rejects many traditional philosophical alternatives. Yet any statement or activity including the action of writing a postmodern account of anything, presupposes at least an implicit conception of reality and values. And so, despite its official distaste for some versions of the abstract, the universal, the fixed, and the precise, postmodernism offers a consistent framework of premises within which to situate our thoughts and actions. Abstracting from the above quotations yields the following. Metaphysically, postmodernism is anti-realist, holding that it is impossible to speak meaningfully about an independently existing reality. Postmodernism substitutes instead a social-linguistic constructionist account of reality. Epistemologically, having rejected the notion of an independently existing reality, postmodernism denies that reason or any other method is a means of acquiring objective knowledge of that reality. Having substituted social linguistic constructs for that reality, postmodernism emphasizes the subjectivity, conventionality, and incommensurability of those constructions. Postmodernist accounts of human nature are consistently collectivist, holding that individuals' identities are largely constructed by the social linguistic groups that they are a part of, those groups varying radically across the dimensions of sex, race, ethnicity, and wealth. Postmodern accounts of human nature also consistently emphasize relations of conflict between those groups. And having de-emphasized or eliminated the role of reason, postmodernist accounts hold that those conflicts are resolved primarily by the use of force, whether masked or naked. The use of force in turn leads to relations of dominance, submission, and oppression. Finally, postmodern themes in ethics and politics are characterized by an identification with and sympathy for the groups perceived to be oppressed in the conflicts, and a willingness to enter the fray on their behalf. The term postmodern situates the movement historically and philosophically against modernism. Thus, understanding what the movement sees itself as rejecting and moving beyond will be helpful in formulating a definition of postmodernism. The modern world has existed for several centuries, and after several centuries, we have a good sense of what modernism is. Modernism and the Enlightenment. In philosophy, modernism's essentials are located in the formative figures of Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, and René Descartes, 1596 to 1650, for their influence upon epistemology, and more comprehensively in John Locke, 1632 to 1704, for his influence upon all aspects of philosophy. Bacon, Descartes, and Locke are modern because of their philosophical naturalism, their profound confidence in reason, and especially in the case of Locke, their individualism. Modern thinkers start from nature instead of starting with some form of the supernatural, which had been the characteristic starting point of pre-modern medieval philosophy. Modern thinkers stress that perception and reason are the human means of knowing nature, in contrast to the pre-modern reliance upon tradition, faith, and mysticism. Modern thinkers stress human autonomy and the human capacity for forming one's own character, in contrast to the pre-modern emphasis upon dependence and original sin. Modern thinkers emphasize the individual, seeing the individual as the unit of reality, holding that the individual's mind is sovereign, and that the individual is the unit of value, in contrast to the pre-modern feudal subordination of the individual to higher political, social, or religious realities and authorities. Modern philosophy came to maturity in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment philosophers quite rightly saw themselves as radical. The pre-modern medieval worldview and the modern Enlightenment worldview were coherent, comprehensive, and entirely opposed accounts of reality and the place of human beings within it. Medievalism had dominated the West for 1,000 years, from roughly 400 CE to 1400 CE. In a centuries-long transition period, the thinkers of the Renaissance, with some unintended help from the major Reformation figures, undermined the medieval worldview and paved the way for the revolutionaries of the 17th and 18th centuries. By the 18th century, the pre-modern philosophy of the medieval era had been routed intellectually, and the philosophers were moving quickly to transform society on the basis of the new modern philosophy. The modern philosophers disagreed among themselves about many issues. But their core agreements outweighed the disagreements. Descartes' account of reason, for example, is rationalist, while Bacon's and Locke's are empiricist, thus placing them at the heads of competing schools. But what is fundamental to all three is the central status of reason as objective and competent, in contrast to the faith, mysticism, and intellectual authoritarianism of earlier ages. Once reason is given pride of place, the entire Enlightenment project follows. If one emphasizes that reason is a faculty of the individual, then individualism becomes a key theme in ethics. Locke's A Letter Concerning Toleration, 1689, and Two Treatises of Government, 1690, are landmark texts in the modern history of individualism. Both link the human capacity for reason to ethical individualism and its social consequences, the prohibition of force against another's independent judgment or action, individual rights, political equality, limiting the power of government, and religious toleration. If one emphasizes that reason is the faculty of understanding nature, then that epistemology systematically applied yields science. Enlightenment thinkers laid the foundations of all the major branches of science. In mathematics, Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz independently developed the calculus, Newton developing his version in 1666 and Leibniz publishing his in 1675. The most monumental publication in the history of modern physics, Newton's Principia Mathematica, appeared in 1687. A century of unprecedented investigation and achievement led to the production of Carolus Linnaeus's Systema Naturae in 1735 and Philosophia Botanica in 1751, jointly presenting a comprehensive biological taxonomy, and to the production of Antoine Lavoisier's Traité élémentaire de chimie, Treatise on Chemical Elements, in 1789, the landmark text in the foundations of chemistry. Individualism and science are thus consequences of an epistemology of reason. Both applied systematically have enormous consequences. Individualism applied to politics yields liberal democracy. Liberalism is the principle of individual freedom, and democracy is the principle of decentralizing political power to individualism. As individualism rose in the modern world, feudalism declined. England's liberal revolution in 1688 began the trend. Modern political principles spread to America and France in the 18th century, leading to liberal revolutions there in 1776 and 1789. The weakening and overthrow of the feudal regimes then made possible the extension, practically, of liberal individualist ideas to all human beings. Racism and sexism are obvious affronts to individualism, and so had been increasingly on the defensive as the 18th century progressed. For the first time ever in history, societies were formed for the elimination of slavery. In America in 1784, in England in 1787, and a year later in France. And in 1791 and 1792, the publication of Olympe de Gouges' Declaration of the Rights of Women and Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women, landmarks in the push for women's liberty and equality. Individualism applied to economics yields free markets and capitalism. Capitalist economics is based on the principle that individuals should be left free to make their own decisions about production, consumption, and trade. As individualism rose in the 18th century, feudal and mercantilist arguments and institutions declined. With the development of free markets came a theoretical grasp of the productive impact of the division of labor and specialization, and of the retarding impact of protectionism and other restrictive regulations. Capturing and extending those insights, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, is the landmark text in the history of modern economics. Theory and practice developed in tandem, and as markets became freer and more international, the amount of wealth available increased dramatically. For example, N.F.R. Kraft's estimates of British average annual income, accepted by both pro- and anti-capitalist historians, show a historically unprecedented rise from $333 in 1700 to $399 in 1760 to $427 in 1800. To $498 in 1830, and then a big jump to $804 in 1860. Science, applied systematically to material production, yields engineering and technology, the new culture of reasoning, experimenting, entrepreneurship, and the free exchange of ideas and wealth meant that by the mid-1700s, scientists and engineers were discovering knowledge and creating technologies on a historically unprecedented scale. The outstanding consequence of this was the Industrial Revolution, which was metaphorically picking up steam by the 1750s and literally picking up steam with the success of James Watt's engine after 1769. Thomas Arkwright's water frame, 1769. James Hargreaves' spinning jenny, around 1769. And Samuel Crompton's mule, 1779, all revolutionized spinning and weaving. Between 1760 and 1780, for example, British consumption of raw cotton went up 540%, from 1.2 to 6.5 million pounds. The rich stuck to their handmade goods for a while, so the first things to be mass-produced in the new factories were cheap goods for the masses. Soap, cotton clothes and linens, shoes, Wedgwood china, iron pots, and so on. Science applied to the understanding of human beings yields medicine. The new approaches to understanding the human being as a naturalistic organism drew upon the new studies, begun in the Renaissance, of human physiology and anatomy. Supernaturalistic and other pre-modern accounts of human ailments were swept aside as, by the second half of the 18th century, medicine put itself increasingly on a scientific footing. The outstanding consequence was that, combined with the rise in wealth, modern medicine increased human longevity dramatically. Edward Jenner's discovery of the smallpox vaccine in 1796, for example, both provided a protection against a major killer of the 18th century and established the science of immunization. Advances in obstetrics both established it as a separate branch of medicine and, more strikingly, contributed to the significant decline of infant mortality rates. In London, for example, the death rate for children before the age of 5 fell from 74.5% in 1730 to 1749 to 31.8% in 1810 to 1829. Modern philosophy matured in the 1700s until the dominant set of views of the era were naturalism, reason and science, tabula rasa, individualism, and liberalism. The Enlightenment was both the dominance of those ideas in intellectual circles and their translation into practice. As a result, individuals were becoming freer, wealthier, living longer, and enjoying more material comfort than at any point before in history. Postmodernism versus the Enlightenment. Postmodernism rejects the entire Enlightenment project. It holds that the modernist premises of the Enlightenment were untenable from the beginning, and that their cultural manifestations have now reached their nadir. While the modern world continues to speak of reason, freedom, and progress, its pathologies tell another story. The postmodern critique of those pathologies is offered as the death knell of modernism. Quote, the deepest strata of Western culture, unquote, have been exposed, Foucault argues, and are, quote, once more stirring under our feet, unquote. Accordingly, states Rorty, the postmodern task is to figure out what to do, quote, now that both the Age of Faith and the Enlightenment seem beyond recovery, unquote. Postmodernism rejects the Enlightenment project in the most fundamental way possible, by attacking its essential philosophical themes. Postmodernism rejects the reason and the individualism that the entire Enlightenment world depends upon. And so it ends up attacking all of the consequences of the Enlightenment philosophy, from capitalism and liberal forms of government to science and technology. Postmodernism's essentials are the opposite of modernism's. Instead of natural reality, anti-realism. Instead of experience and reason, linguistic social subjectivism. Instead of individual identity and autonomy, various race, sex, and class groupisms. Instead of human interests as fundamentally harmonious and tending toward mutually beneficial interaction, conflict and oppression. Instead of valuing individualism in markets, values and politics, calls for communalism, solidarity and egalitarian restraints. Instead of prizing the achievements of science and technology, suspicion tending toward outright hostility. That comprehensive philosophical opposition informs the more specific postmodern themes in the various academic and cultural debates. Postmodern academic themes. Postmodern literary criticism rejects the notion that literary texts have objective meanings and true interpretations. All such claims to objectivity and truth can be deconstructed. In one version of deconstruction, represented by those who agree with the quotation from Stanley Fish earlier, literary criticism becomes a form of subjective play in which the reader pours subjective associations into the text. In another version, objectivity is replaced by the view that an author's race, sex, or other group membership most deeply shapes the author's views and feelings. The task of the literary critic, accordingly, is to deconstruct the text to reveal the author's race, sex, or class interests. Authors and characters who least embody the correct attitudes are naturally subject to the greatest amount of deconstruction. Nathaniel Hawthorne, for example, in The Scarlet Letter, seems at least ambivalent about Hester Prynne's moral status, and this ambivalence reveals that he has sold out to an authoritarian, conformist, and repressive masculine religious establishment. Or Herman Melville in Moby Dick may have thought he was exploring universal themes of personal and social ambition, man and nature, but what Captain Ahab really represents is the exploitative authoritarianism of imperialistic patriarchalism and the insane drive of technology to conquer nature. In law, versions of legal pragmatism and critical legal theory embody the new wave. For the pragmatist version of postmodernism, any abstract and universal theory of the law is to be distrusted. Theories are worthwhile only to the extent that they provide the lawyer or judge with useful verbal tools. Standards for usefulness, however, are subjective and variable, so the legal world becomes a postmodernist battleground. As there are no universally valid legal principles of justice, arguments become rhetorical battles of wills. The critical legal theorists represent the race, class, and sex version of legal postmodernism. According to the crits, legal constitutions and precedents are essentially indeterminate, and the so-called objectivity and neutrality of legal reasoning are frauds. All decisions are inherently subjective and driven by preference and politics. The law is a weapon to be used in the social arena of subjective conflict, an arena driven by competing wills and the coercive assertion of one group's interests over those of other groups. In the West, for too long, the law has been a cover for the assertion of white male interests. The only antidote to that poison is the equally forceful assertion of the subjective interests of historically oppressed groups. Stanley Fish marries the pragmatist and crit approaches in arguing that if lawyers and judges come to think of themselves as, quote, supplementers, unquote, rather than, quote, textualists, unquote, they, quote, will be, therefore, marginally more free than they otherwise would be to infuse into constitutional law their current interpretations of our society's values, unquote. In education, postmodernism rejects the notion that the purpose of education is primarily to train a child's cognitive capacity for reason in order to produce an adult capable of functioning independently in the world. That view of education is replaced with the view that education is to take an essentially indeterminate being and to give it a social identity. Education's method of molding is linguistic. And so the language to be used is that which will create a human being sensitive to its racial, sexual, and class identity. Our current social context, however, is characterized by oppression that benefits whites, males, and the rich at the expense of everyone else. That oppression, in turn, leads to an educational system that reflects only or primarily the interests of those in positions of power. To counteract that bias, education practice must be recast totally. Postmodern education should emphasize works not in the canon. It should focus on the achievements of non-whites, females, and the poor. It should highlight the historical crimes of whites, males, and the rich. And it should teach students that science's method has no better claim to yielding truth than any other method, and, accordingly, that students should be equally receptive to alternative ways of knowing. Postmodern cultural themes. These broad academic themes, in turn, inform our more specific cultural debates. Whether the Western canon of great books is a distillation of the best of the West and reflective of a multifaceted debate, or whether it is ideologically narrow, exclusive, and intolerant. Whether Christopher Columbus was a modern hero, bringing two worlds together to their mutual benefit, or whether he was an insensitive, smugly superior point man for European imperialism, bringing armed force that rammed European religion and values down indigenous cultures' throats. Whether the United States of America is progressive on liberty, equalities, and opportunities for everyone, or whether it is sexist, racist, and class-bound, for example, using its mass-market pornography and glass ceilings to keep women in their place. Whether our ambivalence over affirmative action programs reflects a strong desire to be fair to all parties, or whether those programs are merely a cynical bone thrown to women and minorities until they seem to be helping, at which point there is a violent reaction by the status quo. Whether social conflicts should be diffused by encouraging the principle that individuals should be judged according to their individual merits and not according to morally irrelevant features such as race or sex. Or whether group identities should be affirmed and celebrated, and whether those who balk at doing so should be sent for mandatory sensitivity training. Whether life in the West, and especially America, is improving, with average longevity and wealth increasing in each generation. Or whether America has abandoned its urban underclass and fostered a bland consumerist culture of shopping malls and suburban sprawl. Whether the liberal West is leading the rest of the world to a freer and more prosperous future, or whether its heavy-handed intrusiveness in foreign policy and its command of the international financial markets are exporting its McJobs to non-Western nations, locking them into the system and destroying their indigenous cultures. Whether science and technology are good for all, extending our knowledge of the universe and making the world healthier, cleaner, and more productive. Or whether science betrays its elitism, sexism, and destructiveness by making the speed of light the fastest phenomenon, therefore unfairly privileging it over other speeds by having chosen the phallic symbol, I, to represent the square root of -1, by asserting its desire to, quote, conquer nature and penetrate her secrets, unquote, and, having done so, by having its technology consummate the rape, by building bigger and longer missiles to blow things up. And whether, in general, liberalism, free markets, technology, and cosmopolitanism are social achievements that can be enjoyed by all cultures, or whether non-Western cultures, since they live simply and in harmony with nature, are superior, and whether the West is arrogantly blind to that fact, being elitist and imperialistic, imposing its capitalism, its science and technology, and its ideology upon other cultures and an increasingly fragile ecosystem. Why postmodernism? What makes all of these debates postmodern is not that the skirmishes are vigorous and heated, but that the terms of the debate have shifted. Modern debates were over truth and reality, reason and experience, liberty and equality, justice and peace, beauty and progress. In the postmodern framework, those concepts always appear in quotation marks. Our most strident voices tell us that, quote, truth, unquote, is a myth, quote, reason, unquote, is a white male Eurocentric construct, quote, equality, unquote, is a mask for oppressions, peace and progress, both quoted, are met with cynical and weary reminders of power or explicit ad hominem attacks. Postmodern debates thus display a paradoxical nature. Across the board, we hear, on the one hand, abstract themes of relativism and egalitarianism. Those themes come in both epistemological and ethical forms. Objectivity is a myth. There is no truth, no right way to read nature or a text. All interpretations are equally valid. Values are socially subjective products. Culturally, therefore, no group's values have special standing. all ways of life from Afghani to Zulu are legitimate. Coexisting with these relativistic and egalitarian themes, we hear, on the other hand, deep chords of cynicism. Principles of civility and procedural justice simply serve as masks for hypocrisy and oppression born of asymmetrical power relations, masks that must be ripped off by crude verbal and physical weapons, ad hominem argument, in-your-face shock tactics, and equally cynical power plays. Disagreements are met not with argument, the benefit of the doubt, and the expectation that reason can prevail, but with assertion, animosity, and a willingness to resort to force. Postmodernism, therefore, is a comprehensive philosophical and cultural movement. It identifies its target, modernism, and its realization in the Enlightenment and its legacy, and it mounts powerful arguments against all of the essential elements of modernism. The existence of any prominent cultural movement raises questions of intellectual history. In the case of postmodernism, independent developments in many intellectual areas, primarily in epistemology and politics, but also in metaphysics, the physical sciences, and our understanding of human nature and values, came together in the middle part of the 20th century. Understanding the development of those independent strands and how and why they came to be woven together is essential to understanding postmodernism. Why is it, for example, that skeptical and relativistic arguments have the cultural power that they do now? Why do they have that power in the humanities but not in the sciences? Why have themes of exhaustion, nihilism, and cynicism come to have the cultural dominance they do? And how can those intellectual themes coexist with a broader culture that is richer, freer, and more vigorous than any culture at any other point in history? Why is it that the leading postmodern thinkers are left in their politics, in most cases far left? And why is it that that prominent segment of the left, the same left that traditionally defended its positions on the modernist grounds of reason, science, fairness for all, and optimism, is now voicing themes of anti-reason, anti-science, all's fair in love and war, and cynicism? The Enlightenment reshaped the entire world, and postmodernism hopes to do the same. Forming such an ambition and developing the arguments capable of mobilizing a movement to realize that ambition is the work of many individuals over several generations. Contemporary second-tier postmodernists, when looking for philosophical support, cite Rorty, Foucault, Lyotard, and Derrida. Those figures, in turn, when looking for heavy-duty philosophical support, cite Martin Heidegger, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Friedrich Nietzsche, and Karl Marx, the modern world's most trenchant critics and its most prophetic voices about the new direction. Those figures, in turn, cite George Hegel, Arthur Schopenhauer, Immanuel Kant, and, to a lesser extent, David Hume. The roots and initial impetus of postmodernism thus run deep. The battle between modernism and the philosophies that led to postmodernism was joined at the height of the Enlightenment. Knowing the history of that battle is essential to understanding postmodernism. Explaining Postmodernism, Chapter 2, The Counter-Enlightenment Attack on Reason. Enlightenment Reason, Liberalism, and Science. The Enlightenment developed those features of the modern world that many now take largely for granted: liberal politics and free markets, scientific progress and technological innovation. All four of those institutions depend upon confidence in the power of reason. Political and economic liberalism depend on confidence that individuals can run their own lives. One gives political power and economic freedom to individuals only to the extent one thinks that they are capable of using it wisely. That confidence in individuals is fundamentally a confidence in the power of reason, reason being the means by which individuals can come to know their world, plan their lives, and interact socially the way that reasonable people do, by trade, discussion, and the force of argument. Science and technology more obviously depend upon confidence in the power of reason. Scientific method is an increasingly refined application of reason to understanding nature. Trusting science's results cognitively is an act of confidence in reason, as is trusting one's life to its technological products. Institutionalizing confidence in the power of reason is the most outstanding achievement of the Enlightenment. One indication of this is that of the thousands of brilliant and hardworking individuals who made the Enlightenment happen, the three men, all of them English, most often identified as being most influential in making the Enlightenment possible are Francis Bacon, for his work on empiricism and scientific method, Isaac Newton, for his work on physics, and John Locke, for his work on reason, empiricism, and liberal politics. Confidence in the power of reason underlay all of their achievements. Their analyses and arguments carried the day, and it was the framework that they developed that provided the intellectual basis for every major development in the 18th century. The beginnings of the Counter-Enlightenment. The Enlightenment confidence in reason, however, upon which all progress had been based, had always been philosophically incomplete and vulnerable. These philosophical weaknesses had emerged clearly by the middle of the 18th century in the skepticism of David Hume's empiricism and the dead end reached by traditional rationalism. The perceived vulnerability of Enlightenment reason was one of the major rallying points for an emerging counter-Enlightenment. The era from 1780 to 1815 is one of the defining periods of the modern era. During those 35 years, Anglo-American culture and German culture split decisively from each other, one following a broadly Enlightenment program, the other a counter-Enlightenment one. The Enlightenment had started in England, and it took England from having been a second-rate European power to being a first-rate one. The rest of Europe noticed, especially the French and the Germans noticed. The French were the first to pick up on the English Enlightenment and to transform brilliantly their own intellectual culture on the basis of it, before the Rousseauians wrested the revolution away from the Lockeans and turned it into the chaos of the Terror. Many Germans, however, had been suspicious of the Enlightenment long before the French Revolution. Some German intellectuals absorbed Enlightenment themes, but most were deeply troubled by its implications for religion, morality, and politics. Enlightenment reason, the critics charged, undermined traditional religion. The leading Enlightenment thinkers were deists, having abandoned the traditional theistic conception of God. God was no longer a personal, caring creator. He was now the supreme mathematician who had, eons ago, designed the universe in terms of the beautiful equations that Johannes Kepler and Newton had discovered. The deist's God operated according to logic and mathematics, not will and whim. The deist's God also seemed to have done his work a long time ago, and to have done it well, meaning that he was no longer needed on the scene to operate the machinery of the universe. Deism thus did two things. It turned God into a distant architect, and it accepted a rational epistemology. Both of those features caused major problems for traditional theism. A distant architect is a far cry from a personal God who is there looking after us or checking up on us day to day. He is not someone we pray to or look to comfort from or fear the wrath of. The deist's God is a bloodless abstraction, not a being that is going to get people fired up in church on Sunday morning and give them a sense of meaning and moral guidance in their lives. An even more important consequence of deism is the loss of faith. To the extent that reason is the standard, faith loses, and the theists of the 18th century knew that. To the extent that reason develops, science develops, and to the extent that science develops, supernaturalistic religious answers to be accepted on faith will be replaced with naturalistic scientific explanations that are rationally compelling. By the middle of the 18th century, everyone had spotted that trend, and everyone knew where it was headed. Even worse, from the perspective of the early counter-Enlightenment thinkers, was the content of the naturalistic answers that science was giving in the 18th century. Science's most successful models then were mechanistic and reductionistic. When applied to human beings, such models posed an obvious threat to the human spirit. What place is there for free will and passion, spontaneity and creativity, if the world is governed by mechanism and logic, causality and necessity? And what about the value consequences? Reason is a faculty of the individual, and respect for reason and individualism had developed together during the Enlightenment. The individual is an end in himself, the Enlightenment thinkers taught, not a slave or a servant of others. His happiness is his own to pursue. and by giving him the tools of education, science, and technology, he can be set free to set his own goals and to chart his own course in life. But what happens, worried the early counter-Enlightenment thinkers, to traditional values of community and sacrifice, of duty and connectedness, if individuals are encouraged to calculate rationally their own gain? Will not such rational individualism encourage cold-blooded, short-range, and grasping selfishness? Will it not encourage individuals to reject long-standing traditions and to sever communal ties, thus creating a non-society of isolated, rootless, and restless atoms? The Enlightenment's championing of reason and individualism thus confronted the early counter-Enlightenment thinkers with the specter of a godless, spiritless, passionless, and amoral future. Horror at that specter was most prevalent among intellectuals in the German states, where the prevailing attitude was hostility toward the Enlightenment. Many drew inspiration from Jean-Jacques Rousseau's collectivist social philosophy. Many drew inspiration from Hume's attack on reason. And many wanted to reinvigorate the German traditions of faith, duty, and ethnic identity that had been undermined by the Enlightenment's emphasis upon reason, the pursuit of happiness, and cosmopolitanism. As the Enlightenment grew in power and prestige in England and France, an emerging counter-Enlightenment gathered its forces in the German states. Our concern in this chapter and the next is with postmodernism's attack on reason. Postmodernism emerged as a social force among intellectuals because in the humanities, the counter-Enlightenment defeated the Enlightenment. The weakness of the Enlightenment account of reason was its fatal flaw. Postmodernism's extreme skepticism, subjectivism, and relativism are the results of a 2 centuries-long epistemological battle. That battle is the story of pro-reason intellectuals trying to defend realist accounts of perception, concepts, logic, but gradually giving ground and abandoning the field, while the anti-reason intellectuals advanced in the sophistication of their arguments and developed increasingly non-rational alternatives. Postmodernism is the end result of the counter-Enlightenment attack on reason. Kant's skeptical conclusion. Immanuel Kant is the most significant thinker of the counter-Enlightenment. His philosophy, more than any other thinker's, buttressed the pre-modern worldview of faith and duty against the inroads of the Enlightenment, and his attack on Enlightenment reason more than anyone else's opened the door to the 19th century irrationalists and idealist metaphysicians. Kant's innovations in philosophy were thus the beginnings of the epistemological route to postmodernism. Kant is sometimes considered to be an advocate of reason. Kant was in favor of science, it is argued. He emphasized the importance of rational consistency in ethics. He posited regulative principles of reason to guide our thinking, even our thinking about religion. And he resisted the ravings of Johann Hamann and the relativism of Johann Herder. Thus, the argument runs, Kant should be placed in the pantheon of Enlightenment greats. That is a mistake. The fundamental question of reason is its relationship to reality. Is reason capable of knowing reality, or is it not? Is our rational faculty a cognitive function, taking its material from reality, understanding the significance of that material, and using that understanding to guide our actions in reality, or is it not? This is the question that divides philosophers into pro- and anti-reason camps. This is the question that divides the rational Gnostics and the skeptics. And this was Kant's question in his Critique of Pure Reason. Kant was crystal clear about his answer. Reality, real noumenal reality, is forever closed off to reason, and reason is limited to awareness and understanding of its own subjective products. Reason has, quote, no other purpose than to prescribe its own formal rule for the extension of its empirical employment, and not any extension beyond all limits of empirical employment, unquote. Limited to knowledge of phenomena that it itself has constructed according to its own design, reason cannot know anything outside of itself, contrary to the, quote, dogmatists, unquote, who had for centuries held out hope for knowledge of reality itself. Kant concluded that, quote, The dogmatic solution is therefore not only uncertain, but impossible, unquote. Thus Kant, that great champion of reason, asserted that the most important fact about reason is that it is clueless about reality. Part of Kant's motivation was religious. He saw the beating that religion had taken at the hands of the Enlightenment thinkers, and he agreed strongly with them that religion cannot be justified by reason. So he realized that we need to decide which has priority, reason or religion. Kant firmly chose religion. This meant that reason had to be put in its proper subordinate place. And so, as he stated famously in the second preface to the first critique, quote, "I here therefore found it necessary to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith," unquote. One purpose of the critique, accordingly, was to limit severely the scope of reason. By closing noumenal reality off to reason, all rational arguments against the existence of God could be dismissed. If reason could be shown to be limited to the merely phenomenal realm, then the noumenal realm, the realm of religion, would be off limits to reason, and those arguing against religion could be told to be quiet and go away. Kant's problematic from empiricism and rationalism. In addition to his religious concerns, Kant was also grappling with the problems that the empiricists and the rationalists had run into in attempting to develop satisfactory accounts of reason. For all of their differences, the empiricists and rationalists had agreed with the broadly Enlightenment conception of reason, that human reason is a faculty of the individual, that it is competent to know reality objectively, that it is capable of functioning autonomously and in accordance with universal principles. Reason so conceived underlay their confidence in science, human dignity, and the perfectibility of human institutions. Of those five features of reason, objectivity, competence, autonomy, universality, and being an individual faculty, Kant concluded that the sad experience of recent philosophy demonstrated that the most fundamental of them, objectivity, must be abandoned. The failures of empiricism and rationalism had shown that objectivity is impossible. For reason to be objective, it must have contact with reality. The most obvious candidate for such direct contact is sense perception. On realist accounts, the senses give us our most direct contact with reality, and they thereby provide the material that reason then organizes and integrates into concepts, those concepts in turn becoming integrated into propositions and theories. If, however, the senses give us only internal representations of objects, then an obstacle is erected between reality and reason. If reason is presented with an internal sensory representation of reality, then it is not directly aware of reality. Reality then becomes something to be inferred or hoped for beyond a veil of sense perception. Two arguments had traditionally generated the conclusion that we are aware only of internal sensory representations. The first was based on the fact that sense perception is a causal process. Since it is a causal process, the argument ran, it seems that one's reason comes to be aware of an internal state at the end of the causal process, and not of the external object that initiated the process. The senses, unfortunately, get in the way of our consciousness of reality. The second argument was based on the fact that the features of sense perception vary from individual to individual, and across time for any given individual. One individual sees an object as red, while another sees it as gray. An orange tastes sweet, but not after tasting a spoonful of sugar. What then is the real color of the object, or the real taste of the orange? It seems that neither can be said to be the real feature. Instead, each sense perception must be merely a subjective effect, and one's reason must be aware only of the subjective effect and not the external object. What both of these arguments have in common is a recognition of the uncontroversial fact that our sense organs have an identity, that they work in specific ways, and that the form in which we experience reality is a function of our sense organs' identities. And they have in common the crucial and controversial premise that our sense organs having an identity means that they become obstacles to direct consciousness of reality. This latter premise was critical for Kant's analysis.
The empiricists had drawn from this analysis of sense perception the conclusion that while we must rely on our sense perceptions, we must always be tentative with regard to our confidence in them. From sense perception, we can draw no certain conclusions. The rationalists had drawn the conclusion that sense experience is useless as a significant source of truths, and that for the source of such truths, we must look elsewhere. This brings us to abstract concepts. The empiricists, stressing the experiential source of all of our beliefs, had held that concepts too must be contingent, as based on sense perception, concepts are two stages removed from reality, and so less certain. And as groupings based on our choices, concepts are human artifices, so they and the propositions generated from them can have no necessity or universality ascribed to them. The rationalists, agreeing that necessary and universal concepts could not be derived from sense experience, but insisting that we do have necessary and universal knowledge, had concluded that our concepts must have a source somewhere other than in sense experience. The problematic implication of this was that if concepts did not have their source in sense experience, then it was hard to see how they could have any application to the sensory realm. What these two analyses of concepts had in common is the following hard choice. If we think of concepts as telling us something universal and necessary, then we have to think of them as having nothing to do with the world of sense experience. And if we think of the concepts as having something to do with the world of sense experience, then we have to abandon the idea of knowing any real universal and necessary truths. In other words, experience and necessity have nothing to do with each other. This premise, too, was critical for Kant's analysis. The rationalists and the empiricists had jointly struck a blow to the Enlightenment confidence in reason. Reason works with concepts, but now we were told to accept either that reason's concepts have little to do with the world of sense experience, in which case science's conception of itself as generating universal and necessary truths about the world of sense experience was in big trouble, or we were told to accept that reason's concepts are merely provisional and contingent groupings of sense experience, in which case science's conception of itself as generating universal and necessary truths about the world of sense experience was in big trouble. Thus, by the time of Kant, the Enlightenment philosophers' account of reason was faltering on two counts. Given their analysis of sense perception, reason seemed cut off from direct access to reality. And given their analysis of concepts, reason seemed either irrelevant to reality or limited to merely contingent truths. Kant's significance in the history of philosophy is that he absorbed the lessons of the rationalists and empiricists and, agreeing with the central assumptions of both sides, transformed radically the terms of the relationship between reason and reality. Kant's essential argument. Kant began by identifying a premise common to both empiricists and rationalists. They had assumed that knowledge must be objective. That is, they took for granted that the object of knowledge sets the terms, and therefore that it was up to the subject to identify the object on the object's terms. In other words, the empiricists and the rationalists were realists. They believed that reality is what it is independently of consciousness, and that the purpose of consciousness is to come to an awareness of reality as it is. In Kant's terms, they assumed that the subject is to conform to the object. Kant then noted that the realist-objectivist assumption had led repeatedly to failure, and, more strikingly, that it must necessarily lead to failure. To demonstrate this, Kant proposed a dilemma for all analyses of knowledge. The first premise of the dilemma is given at the beginning of the transcendental deduction. Here Kant states that the knowledge of objects can come to be only in one of two ways. Quote, "There are only two possible ways in which synthetic representations, that is, what one experiences, and their objects can establish connection, obtain necessary relation to one another, and, as it were, meet one another. Either the object alone must make the representation possible, or the representation alone must make the object possible." Unquote. The terms of the dilemma are crucial, particularly for the first alternative. If we say that, quote, "the object alone must make the representation possible," then we imply that the subject must have nothing to do with the process. The implication is that the subject can have no identity of its own, that the mind must not be anything in particular, that consciousness must be, to borrow a phrase, a purely, quote, diaphanous medium, unquote, on which or through which reality writes itself. In other words, Kant assumed, as had most thinkers before him, that objectivity presupposes naive realism's metaphysics of an identityless subject. But clearly, that metaphysics of mind is hopeless. This was Kant's next premise. The knowing subject is something. Its processes are causal and definite, and they shape the subject's awareness. In Kant's words, when we experience, quote, we always remain involved in conditions, unquote, conditions that make our experiences, quote, a finite synthesis, unquote. This is why naive realism has been an impossible project. The knowing subject is not a blank, identityless tablet, so it cannot be that the object alone makes knowledge possible. Given its finite identity, the knowing subject is implicated in producing its experience, and from the limited and conditioned experiences that are produced, the subject cannot read off what is really real. Thus we arrive at the second alternative, the one that Kant proposed as being true, namely that the representation makes the object possible. And thus we have part of the motivation for Kant's, quote, Copernican, unquote, revolution in philosophy, announced in the second preface. Given that the knowing subject has an identity, we must abandon the traditional assumption that the subject conforms to the object. Accordingly, the converse must be true. The object must conform to the subject, and only if we make that assumption, that is, only if we abandon objectivity for subjectivity, can we make sense of empirical knowledge. The second part of Kant's motivation was attempting to make sense of necessary and universal concepts and propositions. Neither the rationalists nor the empiricists had found a way to derive them from experience. Kant again faulted their assumption of realism and objectivism. Those assumptions made the project impossible. Quote, in the former case, that is, the object alone making the representation possible, this relation is only empirical, and the representation is never possible a priori, unquote. Or, putting the point in language Kant had learned from Hume, passive experience will never reveal what must be, for such experience, quote, teaches us that a thing is so-and-so, but not that it cannot be otherwise, unquote. So again, we must infer that the converse is